Going back to the 12th, as we think about what happened to the Carmona regime and how it grew and then collapsed very quickly, it's still amazing to me and very difficult to quite grasp why things went down the way they did. I mean, it's because what I have understood is that Carmona, certainly with Pérez Leical and with Landi Urruen and with a set of a small number of other people, General González González, you should tell me who else is in the script, Ramírez Pérez, of course, had been conspiring, and then they've said so themselves in the videos that came out. It seems like the world's most incompetent conspiracy, and that it is impossible to understand. Everybody in Venezuela, I think, has some sense as to the armed forces, the army, the navy, the air force, what kind of roles they play. Everybody knows that the navy, well, it's the least, well, I don't want to say least respected, but the least formidable of them, and that a navy man, well, is almost never defense minister, because it's just, even in normal times, it's very difficult for navy people to really command the loyalty and the respect of the entire armed forces, and that's why they don't get picked, and that's just a fact. And I think when people go into the navy, they know that. They picked a navy guy for defense minister in the middle of this mess. Help me.
Well, yeah, I think you're right, and I think that all of us, anyone who, most Venezuelans sort of struggle with, okay, what happened here? How did this thing sort of happen, and how is it that it collapsed so quickly? And a lot of that, I think, comes down to the sort of improvisation that occurred. That's one factor. Improvisation, this sort of unprecedented event, sort of took most people by surprise. People who were sort of quick to sort of take advantage of it could get their foot in the door. Carmona, and his group able to sort of be there at the right place at the right time, but then not really knowing exactly what, they should do. The other point I wanted to make about sort of why it collapsed so quickly is this really strong sense of ethnocentricity, really, within the within that small group, within Carmona and the sort of group that he brought around him. The idea that, okay, we're in power now, therefore it's okay that we're in power now, and we feel that everyone must feel like we do. Okay, that everyone must hate, despise, loathe Hugo Chavez just as much as we do. So that the series of actions that they took, dissolving the National Assembly, the Supreme Court, the Defender of the People, going back to the previous constitution, that
The name
everyone,
of the country.
even the name of the country, that this sort of complete sort of reversal, and because they felt so strongly, they were so adamant about their sort of rancor against Hugo Chavez, they sort of felt that, oh, everyone must feel this way. And yes, it's true, there was a huge march. There was a huge opposition to Chavez. Opinion polls at the time show his approval rating at 30% or below. He was very unpopular, but there's also a whole list of things, problems with Venezuela that he was brought into office to fix. And many people still felt, they believe in him, just as many do now, or they believed in him then and felt that his mandate, that those were the things that still needed to be addressed. So you can't just, wipe away the whole thing, the complete 3 years that Hugo Chavez had been in power up to that time, because you or your group in particular feels that he was dictatorial or autocratic or a Castro wannabe. So it's that sort of ethnocentricity that you see in Venezuela. It's interesting because Venezuela has such extremes of culture. You have on one side such a large percent of the population that lives in shanty towns, and then you have a squalido, so the oligarchy, or however you want to call it. And of course, I'm dealing with stereotypes here, but sometimes those are kind of helpful in understanding the idea of this sort of rich elite that is very out of touch with what's going on in Venezuela. So in many ways, the collapse of the coup represented that, because Carmona represented this very far end of this sort of cultural gap. And his actions represent his point of view at that end of the Venezuelan culture. But, of course, those actions that were ignoring the point of view of the other extreme.
I guess just before 5 a.m. on the 12th, there is this strange moment where Carmona says, I will be interim president. And somehow people lined up behind that.
And, yes.
And
yes.
It's, and of course, I mean, now it's very hard to get a proper accounting as to how that happened. Obviously, everybody was dead tired and not really thinking straight at that time. But it's also striking that, you know, maybe I could have walked into Fuerte Tiuna and said, hey, I'm going to be interim president. And people would have said, yeah, okay.
Yes. You know, could you have won the lottery that day? And you could have been Pedro Carmona, which is that funny anecdote that Miss Munoz told me about when she went to Miraflores that day, and she was a reporter. And after the press conference, when Carmona had dissolved the powers and everybody was scrambling to interview the other new opposition cabinet ministers, she actually accidentally sits down in the presidential chair, and another reporter says, oh, well, look, this is exactly symbolizes what's going on in Venezuela, that, you know, anyone can put their culo in the presidential chair. But yeah, I think there was a certain amount of feeling within the military, and the strong feeling within the military, that they could not put their own face on the transitional government. General Vasquez Velasco feels that he backed Carmona because if he had picked or pressured a military person to take that role, or if he himself had taken that role, the people would have rejected it. So Pedro Carmona is actually the logical choice in many ways. It would either be him or, I think, Carlos Ortega. Those were the two principal leaders of the opposition movement at the time. Carmona had a lot more experience in government, having been in the foreign ministry. He also had a lot of strong business contacts, of course. So in many ways, he is actually the logical choice. And again, if you're doing all this improvisation, if you're doing all this stuff that's sort of on the fly, you know, he was sort of the most digestible civilian that you could find for that position.
Let me ask you about, so long as we're on mysterious things that happened on territory. One thing that I've never really been able to piece together is General Medina Gomez's role. But especially what I haven't been able to piece together is the government's response in the propaganda war after the coup to Medina Gomez's trips. Because you make a big point of saying that Chavez throughout the 11th was sure that Medina Gomez was leading some kind of rebellion, and that stands to reason. If you really think that the U.S. is out to get you, obviously the far-right-wing Venezuelan military attaché in Washington would be the guy on whom suspicions would naturally fall. But what's interesting is that after the coup, and despite the millions and millions of dollars and the tons of ink and the movies and the propaganda pamphlets and everything else that Chavismo has put out to try to blame the Americans for what happened, Medina Gomez is really soft-pedaled and often just not mentioned at all in that context. So can you help me with that?
I'm not sure how much light I can shed on General Medina Gomez, because in my investigation, sort of like you say, he sort of comes in and out, but there's never really much concrete evidence there. He himself felt that, well, I think rightly so, and I think he had this right, is that Chavez knew about some of the more serious coup conspiracies within the military, and that he was letting them sort of run their course. And so it sounds like he kind of was wise to that and was sort of not trying to get involved. He felt that Chavez was probably going to use any sort of uprising as a major excuse to purge the military of anyone that he suspected of disloyalty, which, of course, he eventually did after the coup. So from what I can tell, Medina Gomez was sort of wise to this. was wise, that any move he made would likely sort of play into Chavez's hand, and was sort of trying to sort of sit back and sort of let things transpire. Now, we don't know whether he might have stepped up a little bit more than he did if Carmona, for example, had been able to sort of consolidate power. Perhaps Medina Gomez would have sort of stepped up and sort of stepped out of the shadows in that situation. But again, it's really speculation. And you're absolutely right. He has sort of remained a sort of nebulous figure throughout this, who sort of comes in and comes out, but is really tough to pin down.
But you do report that he flew to Venezuela in a Perez Lecao plane.
Yes, yes. So, and that's another thing that was tough to write about, because there's just not a whole lot of information there. Yes, it's true that Isaac Perez Lecao was giving a lot of help to the opposition leaders. He was extremely, seemed to almost have a personal vendetta against Chavez, was doing everything he could to get Chavez out of power. And that was one of the things that he did. He flew Medina Gomez back to Venezuela at this sort of critical juncture. On the other hand, I'm not really sure how much weight we should put on that, because from the character and the sort of portrait of Isaac Perez Lecao that I was able to sort of put together, I'm really not convinced that we're talking about someone who was really masterminding an elaborate plot. So I can see him sort of playing as much as he can into the game, but I've been resistant to sort of put him in the role of someone who's kind of manipulating a lot of characters and really had that much control and influence.
So who is in that role?
Yeah, who is it, right? And that's just, there's a lot of points where we still don't have names. For example, several people were willing to testify about the meeting between Hugo Chavez and the generals at Fort Tituna, and the sort of banter or discussion back and forth, and that some of the generals were resistant to letting Chavez fly to Cuba. They insisted that he stay and stand trial. The names of those people don't really come out. Who were the specifically the ones who were saying, no, you cannot leave. You have to stand trial.
We don't know.
Yeah.
Listen, maybe we should stand back from this kind of micro level,
sure.
Monday morning, or, you know, Monday morning, 7 years later, quarterback,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And look at the bigger picture.
Sure.
Your book seems, you know, both a really badly needed contribution to this pivotal event, and I really, you know, I'm just so glad that you took the time to do the topic justice. So, you know, I really feel
thank
like
you.
I need to thank you. But it also seems like a case of extremely tardy barn door shutting, in that everybody already knows what happened in April 11th. I mean, the stories that ossify, and then there are stories that ossify and congeal and then get compressed into diamonds of immutable, super hardened conventional wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's April 11th. I mean, it seems like what people were going to think about what happened, they already think. So I wonder how you think your role is, and your research's role is in that dynamic, and how you motivate yourself to keep researching a topic that, you know, to many people is just beyond repair.
Yeah, yeah. At points in doing my research, I felt like someone trying to figure out the Kennedy assassination, you know, that you've been completely inundated with so much conflicting information, so many different conspiracy theories piled on top of each other, so much disinformation that it was in many ways overwhelming. But that sort of fed into the structure of the book and the idea to use sort of multiple points of view. But really my goal was less to be the unequivocal voice of April 11th as it was to sort of just show the reader what Venezuela is going through and what Venezuela went through in those 72 hours. So, yeah, I'm sure the book will be used as a resource for saying, okay, this we know this happened at this time because it's in The Silence and the Scorpion. However, I hope the book reaches a much wider audience than people who already know about April 11th. I want this to be a book that anyone can interact with, regardless of their connection to Venezuela or their interest, and see how these interesting political events sort of unfold. Again, as I said earlier in the interview, is I want this to be a representation of Venezuela, not so much a research piece that's going to be used solely in academia.
Why, in the end, do you think Chavez was able to ride out the coup?
I think Chavez was able to ride out the coup because his group was the most prepared. Hugo Chavez, being a military man, being someone who had led a coup, being someone who was extremely preoccupied with being overthrown, with assassination, with people trying to get him, he was prepared in many ways. There was no auto coup, as some believe. There was no sort of, this whole thing was not orchestrated by him. However, he was the one who had taken all these steps to organize his party and his followers. So when you look at what happened, the people who were quickest to act were those who supported Hugo Chavez. People like Guillermo Garcia Ponce, who, without hesitation, as soon as Chavez surrendered himself to the military, began working on how to get him back into power. The fact that Chavez was so sort of always on high alert for about a coup, always warning, oh, someone's trying to strike a coup against me, someone's out to get me, that creates this sense of readiness within the people who are loyal to him. And that's why I think he was able to survive, is because people like Guillermo Garcia Ponce, people like General Badwell, those people were able to act with the most discipline and resolve in the face of these very confused, chaotic events. So.
And yet there's also this strange confluence of events where clearly throughout the 11th, Chavez believed that what he was facing was a traditional kind of conspiracy. And so in fact, what he was not prepared for was that its absence, right?
Yes, exactly. And that's probably, for me, one of the most interesting ironies of April 11th is that Chavez, being the leftist revolutionary that he is, and being a man who once led a coup, assumed that this march on his palace was just the precursor to a military strike. And because he felt that way, he took certain two major countermeasures. And those two countermeasures are what resulted in his being ousted from power. One of those was that he called Plan Avila, which his military refused, an order that the military refused to follow because it was illegal to use that plan of operations against a civilian population. And then the other preemptive thing that he did was he allowed his militia groups, the Bolivar Encircles, to defend one of the routes that the march would take to Miraflores. When that happened, and they stopped the march with gunfire, and that was captured on TV, that was the other pivotal thing that caused the military to refuse to follow his orders. So Chavez, in thinking that he was facing a classic coup, actually caused his own sort of ouster because he took two actions that actually caused a military that might not have revolted to revolt.
But what you're saying then is that the order to call out Plan Avila and to send out the Bolivarian circles, as they were at the time, clearly quite heavily armed, were in reaction not to what in fact happened, but what was supposed to happen that didn't happen.
Exactly. And Chavez, his actions throughout the day demonstrate that he thought this was a military, there was a military plan by conspiring generals to attack Miraflores and arrest him or kill him. And you can see that as soon as he finishes his national broadcast, he goes and changes out of his suit and puts on his military fatigues and gets his rifle. He's told General Rosendo the night before that, you know, he's willing to put lead in anyone who tries to stop his revolution. He believes that this is a classic coup. And when he gets to Fort Tatiuna, after he turns himself in, okay, it's only then that he kind of realizes that, hey, this is not the coup that I thought it was. He had assumed that this was a situation where all the generals were working together. They'd had this all planned for months. But in reality, he can see, once he sees them arguing about what to do with him, there was no such plan. And that's when he changes his mind. That's when he says, okay, I'm not resigning.
Right, but that's the second irony, that the same lack of planning that caused the army to revolt allowed him to get back in.
Exactly. The fact that this was more a cascading event of errors and mistakes rather than a premeditated, orchestrated plan. Yeah, that's exactly right. The only evidence that we have of an attack is actually really just a threat that General Fuenmayor made in sort of the heat of the moment after General Rincon has announced that Chavez will resign. And they're ready to, they want him in custody, and he calls the palace in a rage and says, you know, if you don't get out of that palace in 15 minutes, then I'm going to send in the F-16s. That's really the only evidence we have of any kind of military strike. And I think it's fair to say that that was said in the moment, and that that was not anything that was premeditated before April 11th.
Like we had F-16 pilots scrambling just then.
Yes. And if they would have been able to get off the ground in Maracay is another big question, right? With that town being much of the military there still loyal to Chavez.
In the version that I had heard, having done much less research than you, it was not Maracay that was largely pro-Chavez and didn't agree with the goings on at Fuertetuna. It was General Baduel. But in your account, it's much less Baduel-centric in dealing with Maracay. So can you describe a little bit for those of us who are hopelessly Caracas-centric and don't think anything ever happens in the interior, what Maracay was like those first 2 days?
Yeah, I think General Baduel is definitely became sort of the iconic figure of the counter-coup. However, I think a lot of people within the military, when they saw Carmona in his famous announcements on April 12th, quickly wanted to distance themselves from him, and also from General Vasquez Velasco, who was seen there in the same room, sort of putting his rubber stamp on this. So I think you had sort of this reaction to the dissolving of Congress and the dissolving of the democratic institutions that really helped Baduel and some of the other generals really quickly kind of come together and build a cohesive group. And I mean, there are enough of them that it seemed prudent for them to sit down and write a long manifesto about their aims. So it sort of demonstrates that there was quite a bit of critical mass there to sort of get that movement going. And I would sort of reiterate that it's a mixture of wanting to save a piece of the revolution, which those generals did, but also responding to Carmona. So I think if Carmona had come in and been much more moderate, if he had not tried to rename the country, get rid of the constitution that was made in 1999, I don't think you would have had General Baduel would not have had the sort of resources and backing that he had within 20 hours of that announcement. But because there's a mixture of both reaction to Hugo Chavez losing power and a reaction against Carmona's seemingly dictatorial acts, that group sort of came together much quicker.
But even then, many in that group were not thinking that their reaction to Carmona was a reaction to bring back Chavez. It seems like there were people dealing with many different scenarios.
Exactly. And again, you know, the most compelling example of that is General Vasquez Velasco, right, who decides that he isn't going to support Carmona But that results in allowing Diosdado Cabello to come back as who was the Chavez vice president to assume the presidency. So that in many ways backfired against him too, because now then he was in a position where Chavez could return, even though he wanted him to Diosdado Cabello to hold new elections. It resulted in a situation where his military career was over because he reacted against Carmona.
Well, that is a real irony there, isn't it? I wonder if you have any final thoughts about the experience of giving over all these years to doing this research.
It's not that often in life that something comes along that warrants such a commitment, something that, you can really get behind, something that you feel so strongly about that you could dedicate so much time and effort to. So one way or another, you do feel that it's something that becomes imperative, and that if you're going to be true to yourself, you have to do it.
Because I don't know, I was looking through the end of the book, which I hadn't read so carefully before, and you really are pretty categorical, actually.
Yeah, anything that kind of stuck out to you
Well, I
about
mean,
that?
you clearly go there in terms of alleging that what happened to the evidence was a cover-up.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at the sort of different things that the government was doing, the way that it treated the victims, the very partial way, biased way that they were treated, those people who supported Chavez were sort of exalted and given all these sort of gifts or special privileges, but those people who had lost family members or been wounded on the other side were completely denied any sort of recourse for what had happened to them. And that sort of, some things just kind of cut through the haze. And when a government's willing to do that and go to that sort of those sort of extremes, it really kind of clarifies things for you in your mind, and so you become very certain about how you feel. In some ways, I was really focused on showing just the 72 hours of crisis and just sort of showing all the evidence that's there. But I also have to admit that as someone who's studied Venezuela and been watching the whole history, not just of Chavez, but particularly of Chavez's time in office, that information also goes into sort of fueling my eventual conclusion. So even the stuff that's going on at the moment, the three police commissioners who were just sentenced to 30 years, that information about that sort of feeds into my own conclusions. The fact that there is really no evidence against those men, yet Chavez feels like someone has to be blamed. There's a lot of pressure, I think, on him to show that, okay, we have fixed this. We've sort of shown, what happened on those days. And the fact that, they're able to do that they'll go to that extreme again sort of really solidifies my feelings about what happened. So even though the book only covers those 72 hours, again, it's supposed to be metaphorical for everything that's going on in Venezuela. And as the author, I think I've let some of that other information filter through so that one can have more of a set conclusion at the end of the book. Because basically, if you've made it with me through the whole book and you're still with me at the conclusion, I feel that it's okay for me to sort of use my voice more than I have throughout the book to say, okay, this is what I feel really happened.
Well, I just want to thank you again, Brian. I think you've done a real service to Venezuela and to our historical memory. And I hope your book does really well. Please buy it if you're listening to this and you're not Brian. It's on Amazon. They'll ship it out at the beginning of next month. And it's a kind of thing that if you're interested in Venezuela and you're interested in the history of the Chavez era and the deeper understanding of what's happened to our country, well, you just can't afford to not own this book. So, yeah, that's what I think.